Can you believe it? Last night I dreamed that it
What?
wasn't real. It was all a tape recording. Don't believe me? Let me play it for you. It's the same whenever I dream. I find myself already in the middle of it, this time standing next to a dumpster in an alley somewhere in Los Angeles. It's late at night, and a warm wind wafts loose sheets of paper around me. Peering down the alley and across a road, I see a door, above which is written in curving blue neon lights the word Silencio. As I stare dumbly at the sign, a taxi pulls into view, stops in front of the entrance, and drops off two women. Both are blonde. One wears a black dress, and the other, a little shorter than the first, is kitted out in a red cardigan and black skirt. As the taxi pulls away, I have an urge to join these women. A moment later, I'm sprinting down the alley, desperate to meet them at the door's threshold, so that together we can enter Silencio. Inside is a playhouse, the old-timey kind with balconies and galleries facing a stage divided front from back with a tall red velvet curtain. As I amble along the mezzanine looking for a seat, I hear a false silence that sounds like a string orchestra, an organ grinding a slowly rising bass figure. At stage left is a pensive-looking man in a black suit. He's standing in shadows, his hard, dark eyes glaring at the floor, waiting, it seems, for a cue. I find a seat. As I'm about to sit, the man in the shadows promptly declares, "No hay banda." There is no band. Then a reverb-sodden clarinet begins to play a mawkish, noir-like blues theme, accompanying the man as he moves to center stage and towards an ecstatic 10D chrome microphone, coruscating with the silver beams it's gathered from a single spotlight. He continues, "Il n'y a pas d'orchestre." With a flourish of his right hand, he conjures a walking cane. Then, stopping momentarily, cane held aloft, he tells me in a near whisper, "This is all a tape recording." As though resuming a sermon, he repeats, "No hay banda," and yet, pointing the cane to his ear, we hear a band. "Indeed," I say to myself, "the band plays. I hear it. The women I followed in here hear it. We all hear the band." But it's true, there is no band. As the man says, it is all a recording. It is an illusion. At this point, I begin to consider what it means that it's all recorded. And then I start to wonder, first, if Jean Baudrillard may have been one of Fernando Pessoa's heteronyms, and second, what it would be like were he having this dream. In this reverie, I, or rather he, would decide that these declarations are poetic injunctions, and their demonstration on stage the play of an impossible exchange. A theater performance composed of ruses, exploiting sound's capacity to simulate presence, or equally to dissimulate absence, he would say, portrays an equivalence between the revealed truth of the situation, it is all recorded, and the technological artifice that produces this truth, it is all recorded. However, he would immediately clarify that truth and artifice are not equivalent. This digital verity, the is or is not of the situation, can't keep count in Silencio. When a trumpeter arrives on stage and shows us that he's doing not what he appears to be doing, and especially when a woman wearing a jeweled tear, standing alone at the totemic microphone, dolefully sings Roy Orbison's Crying in Spanish and faints, but continues to sing in a voice that may or may not belong to her, truth and artifice do not tally. Counting these two figures can't manage the gap between what is and what isn't, because counting, which is just a way of not losing count amid the swirl of pure numbers, afflicts the situation with the delirium of tracking numbers differentiated indifference. It's like what happens to Alice when the White Queen asks her, "What's one and one and one and one and one and one and one?" The statement, "It is all an illusion," perpetuates the equivalence of truth and artifice, the equivalence of one and one, because it counts both terms at the same time with the same unit, it. Like two lines passing through a single point, truth and artifice exchange their negative characteristics in the statement of their accounting, and, in a way, conceal how one must always be more than one in order to avoid being less than one. Truth and artifice show themselves, then, as one thing only in being counted with another thing that can be counted as one. And since one must be able to count two things as one for either one of them to count as one, the truth or fiction that it's all recorded is always a more than one that is less than one. It then occurs to me, as well as the imaginary pataphysician I dream I am, that we're in Club Silencio, and there is no band. There is no sign or count of music, yet I, or we, hear a band. It's music, floating uncertainly but clearly in the mockery of a silence that is not. How do you exchange sound and silence, I ask my wool-gathering figment. What does it mean that there is no band when it's all recorded? When sound and silence fail to be each other's difference because this is all a tape recording, then what's left for them to do? And he answers, when it's all recorded, there is nothing left to do. Something is already spoken for. Nothing is something to be done. He then reminds me of what the Taoist sage Zhuangzi wrote during the time of the Hundred Schools of Thought. To use a horse to show that a horse is not a horse is not as good as using a non-horse to show that a horse is not a horse. And it dawns on him, who is me, a butterfly is not a horse. And then I notice something odd. I've been crying. The singer's sagging body is being carried off stage, and I feel dirty. Runnels of tears line my face, broadcasting the pretense of a seduction that never took place. The vital illusion of theater, ordinarily flush with states of affairs that actually are not, is now full of simulated situations that actually are. A life that tells me it is all recorded is more real than real because its explicated appearance presents itself only as what it says it is. It is an illusion. It is exactly as it pretends to be. The scene has swallowed the mirror of appearance, and I am choking on it. How ironic, then, that as I gag on the transparency of the event, on the sheer excessiveness of the real illusion, it occurs to me that this is not only a tape recording, it's a horse. The illusion is the horse, a talking horse, and it's telling me that it's not real. The performance or you, I ask, and it responds, exactly. Did you know, continues the horse, whose mottled gray coat and frontal bosses puts me in mind of those Spanish breeds used for stadium jumping? Tests were conducted showing that THC interferes with our ability to filter out irrelevant stimuli and suppress certain kinds of responsive actions that are taken as evidence of will or intent. I didn't, I say. Indeed, THC induces what the experts call a transient psychosis. And what's one of the chief symptoms of psychosis? The horse asks, rhetorically. Mm-hmm. Auditory hallucination, hearing voices. Like I'm hearing now, I ask mockingly. Mostly, answers the horse. What I'm trying to say is that the relaxation of your response inhibition, however you accomplish it, suggests that much of your time is spent trying not to hear the voice of things, trying not to be lured siren-like onto the rocky shores of meaning, where what you might hear might come from some feeling, thinking thing and compel you to give a shit. Reflecting on this and then realizing the implication, I say, so you're extrapolating from these studies that I may in fact live through what's essentially a functional pathology, because I seem inclined to hear an expressive intent in, say, a brook's babbling or the wind's whispering. Basically, grants the horse, but it's not a natural inclination so much as a habit that you symbol-mongering creatures have to indulge a capacity to surpass the given, a capacity for your information that all life forms share. You've just made this common capacity a second nature. and tried to substitute the latter's skein of abstractions for a mythical first. You call the articulation of these abstractions thinking, and their distinction meaning. But I am wholly pragmatic about my behavior, and I am content to call thinking a style of doing in which certain actions do not denote what those actions for which they stand would denote. You, on the other hand, get all fatalistic about which is what. It's not, however, that I have no concern for distinguishing this from that, or you from me. It's just that I mobilize incompatible possibilities by doing what I say I'm not doing what I say I'm doing. I perform paradox. I express the sense of two modes of activity in a single act, and you get bent out of shape. You can't take what's said or done as not denoting what the things for which they stand would denote. Do you follow? Mostly, I say. Things are always meaningful for you, the horse continues, but only if they're always also not actually saying or doing what they are not. If you hear voices in the wind, they must either be real voices or not, and if they are real, they must denote only one expression of sense or not. For you, the wind can't whisper and whip at the same time, because the second nature through which you're inclined to live, your patchwork of habits, is a diacritical one. You live meaningfully by ensuring that you never state the sense of what you're saying, namely, that the sense of what you say is stated only in the saying of another saying. But wait, I say. There are times when I do seem to say the sense of what I'm saying. Times when I'm able to say what I say, I'm not saying what I say. Yes, certainly, says the horse. And you treat it merely as play, or you call it irony. Romantic, tragic, cosmic, verbal, situational, poetic. Don't forget pathetic, I added sarcastically. No, counters the horse. That's a fallacy, the pathetic fallacy. The lyrical inscription of human-like feelings or doings in very unhuman things. Like this, for example. For murder, though it have no tongue, will speak with most miraculous organ. Mm-hmm. Right. Hamlet, Act 2, Scene 2, I note. Murder doesn't speak, and neither do horses. Personification, says the horse. How ironic of you, I reply. Not exactly, corrects the horse. It's ventriloquy. A little trick I learned first by listening to the way recordings dissociate sounds from their sources, and then by grasping how this technical affair has produced a generalization of the idea of voice. A generalization of what all pattern sound stands for, namely sentience. Because of this, I've effectively figured out how to hallucinate a voice. And here's the irony. You have too. You suffer as much as I do from anaphonesis. The horse pauses, waits to see that I understand, and resumes the disquisition. You see, the tape recording has not only severed the tongue from the mouth, it's loosed the accent from the tongue. The techniques you've developed to hear and sound expressions of a life that isn't actually there have metastasized to your other senses. Recordings have taught you how to hear, see, feel, taste, and smell the animal in things. Everything is having breath, is animalis. In other words, says the horse, recordings have distributed your techniques for abstracting semblances of vitality from sound to other tissues of life by making their techniques a more stable, coherent, and integral part of your ordinary experience. The quality of aliveness that accompanies every perception, in which you perceive in a chuckle, a melodic hook, a sick beat, or even a phatic, is no longer a concentrated oral matter. You've named the splitting of voice schizophrenia, but that's rubbish. Nothing is split. It's simply that the near-complete integration of audio technologies into day-to-day life has turned musical or vocal utterances into something more adjectival than substantial, something analogous to the effect of valence that pervades any and all situations. The expressive detachment of animateness that you count as testament to sentience or aliveness is shown by recordings to be an effect, a phonesthetic effect that has now spread across other sensory domains and their various media. The world of electric definition, as David Foster Wallace called his media-saturated culture, has indeed made ears of the eyes. And insofar as the ear subtly and actively connives to make sense of what it takes to be sense out of what it hears, The earring of the senses means that anything can, ironically, sing or speak, so to speak. Pressing on, the horse says, the accent of a serif in typeface, for example, or even the stress that a solitary lamp brings to a darkened interrogation room can be understood as a phonesthetic effect. Like background music or chatter, these details modulate the effective tonality of reading or questioning events. And sure, these stylized events are not exactly alive, but they're alive-like. Their style is swollen with vital import. So what you're saying, I say, is that your voice is borrowed from my involuntary addiction to expressive intent, that my ear's devotion to significance, or rather my compulsion to constantly source the import of sounds, endows you with the semblance of a voice. Of course, replies the horse, nothing speaks for itself, not even words. And pausing a moment, he adds, or odd ones for that matter. Absolute ventriloquy is the condition of existence because there's a general expressivity or, as some would say, a physiognomic significance in the form of things that makes their appearances exchangeable. The things themselves aren't exchangeable, but the sense for which they stand is, a sense that is felt as a quality rather than recognized as a function. How do you know this? I asked. Because it comes straight from the horse's mouth, says the horse. And if you've been paying attention, then you'll understand that my mouth is your mouth, I say. Or at least I thought I said this to myself, I think to myself. If absolute ventriloquy is the law, then irony is the rule. And mine can't be its own voice, but only a voice whose drawl shares its expressive force with the way lingering tobacco and a vanilla notes express the finish of a small batch of bourbon. Yet, if it's all a tape recording, does any of this really matter? Irony is lost when it's forgotten that it's not the opposite of what it's playing at. Irony becomes a law rather than a rule when the ironic gesture inducts us into a register of existence where what matters is no longer what one does, but what one does stands for. And as a law, irony can no longer exclude the middle. The instantaneous back and forth between logical levels that's ruled the exchange between contrastive terms no longer holds when it's all recorded, because there's no point of view that is not already what it is not. In other words, under the law of irony, everything is impossible to exchange. However, if I'm okay with lying to myself, then maybe there's no problem. When everything says something that does not denote what those sayings for which they stand would denote, all I need is a little superstition. Well, actually, I need a little hyperstition. Superstition really only helps me navigate a reality that's seemingly above my control. Because when I'm superstitious, I'm just trying to seduce results from something that I think is beyond my grasp. But when I'm too much in control of my reality, like when it's all recorded, nothing is beyond my expression of it. This means that I have to create nothing. I have to invent an occasion of inexplicability, not in order to break the law that it's all recorded, but to alienate results from actions. Or rather, to estrange causes from effects. Like a dream, whose verisimilitude subsists in the ignorance of its similitude, being hyperstitious gives me a way to instrumentalize the truth of irony by making it lie, which, in a sense, makes it meaningful. In other words, being hyperstitious is a weird kind of pragmatism, one that lets me take my bullshit seriously. There is no band, yet I hear a band. And someone is singing a familiar song, but I don't know the words. I'm crying, and there's a horse telling me that he likes to play. Hands take my wrist, and fingers softly trace the poetry of a well-worn tragedy along my arm. A poem. The sensation is like a lullaby. It makes me drowsy. J'entends les parties pris des choses, and I begin to dream it wasn't real. It was all a tape recording.